better to do than for us to not only pray for our brothers and sisters in places where they're oppressed and can't follow their faith freely, but to pray the scriptures is even better. I can't exclaim the wonders of that enough, the idea of praying scripture, not only over our own lives, but over one another's lives, and in this case, perfect to pray that over the lives of our brothers and sisters who are real family, who face things that we haven't even got a clue of what it's like to experience that. So thank you, Melissa. I appreciate that. This morning, we're going to just kind of jump into our Bible study. So if you have a way of following along, and if you'd like to, head over to... did I hit the wrong button? I don't want to look at that all day. Maybe somebody can help me out and get the Matthew slideshow up there. But we're going to be continuing our study in the Gospel of Matthew. If you've got a way of following along, either a Bible or a Bible app, if you'll head over to Matthew chapter 25, please. We're in a section where Jesus says, unless you've been a public speaker and have been competing with a slideshow who's out of control, you have no idea what it really is to live. We're in a section where Jesus has been talking to his disciples about the coming of God's kingdom. And the Greek word that's used for that is parousia. It means the revelation or the unveiling of something, the revelation of Jesus as the king. And he's been telling stories, what Jesus has been doing, oh Lord. Okay. Is there a reason that this is still happening? Is there like a way to turn the computer off or something even? Anyway. Whew, thank you. And I feel for them, you know, because you know they're back there sweating bullets trying to figure out what's going on. So anyway, it's technology. You know, you go to Haiti or you go to any real place and, you know, you got dirt floors for a church service. And here we're, you know, freaking out because our media is not working. Anyway, so Jesus has been telling stories to try to get across, you know, what the imminence of his kingdom is like. He's been telling several stories, but in these stories that he's been telling, he's been actually trying to get across a few concepts. One concept he's trying to get across is that there's going to be a delay in the parousia. It's going to take longer than everybody was anticipating. There's going to be a period of time where Jesus has not been revealed as king yet, and everybody's waiting for that to happen. You know, we call that, when we talk about Jesus being revealed, we call that the second coming of Christ. We believe that Jesus came incarnationally the first time and concluded his earthly ministry, his public ministry, in his death and then subsequent resurrection and ascension. And now we're waiting for his return, the second coming of Christ. But when we're talking about that, we're talking about the unveiling of Jesus as the true king. The second thing that he was trying to get across in these stories that he was telling is that we don't know when this is going to be happening. We don't know when his appearance is going to take place. And so he wants us to live in a state of readiness, to be ready all the time, since we don't know the day or the hour. Last week, we looked at a parable about Jewish wedding traditions that encouraged us to stay alert, to stay with the wedding party, no matter what is happening here, because the appearance of the groom is going to come unexpectedly in a time when nobody knows. And now today, Jesus is going to tell another story intended to emphasize another point associated with our waiting during the delay. So, you know, we want to wait, we want to be prepared, but what do we do while we wait? The delay has taken a lot longer than anybody thought. We're 2,000 years into this, and so what do we do? What have we been doing? What should we be doing? And Jesus tells a story to give us an idea about that. So if you're there in Matthew chapter 25, we're going to pick up where we left off, starting with verse 14. Jesus is the one doing the talking. He says, "For it will be like," and when he says "it," he's talking about the coming of the kingdom of God. "It will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted them with his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. He also, so also he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the one talent went and dug it in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. And those who had received the five, and he who had received the five talents came forward, bringing five talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me five talents. Here, I've made you five talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I'll set you over much. Enter in the joy of your master. And he also who had the two talents came forward saying, Master, you delivered to me two talents. And here, I've made two talents more. And his master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I'll set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. He also who had received the one talent came forward saying, Master, I know you to be a hard man, reaping where you didn't sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid. And I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what's yours. But his master answered him, You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I haven't sown and gather where I scattered no seed? Then you ought to have invested my money with bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, or will more be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. We've had that theme coming up pretty regularly all the way through this. A lot of teeth grinding in these stories. Okay, so that's where we're going to stop today. I read the whole section there. We're going to go through and kind of unpack it and see what this is saying. It's another parable that's a tricky one to decipher and to apply. And it's you know, not no small amount of problems. There are some inherent problems with it that we touch on or that we observe right off the bat. Some people balk at this story. Some people recoil from this altogether, and they feel like it is, in how we're going to apply it, they say that it's strangely out of tune with the Old Testament laws, which have commands about, you know, not charging any interest or making money from money. So they say we can't read this parable and understand this as a picture of God as the landowner there, because he certainly, you know, wouldn't be doing that. So the way we have to read this parable is that this is God warning us how not to be involved in certain economic or financial systems. The thing about that is it just does not work at all within the context that we find this story in. We find this story in the middle of a bunch of stories that Jesus is telling in order to describe the delayed coming of God's kingdom and our response to that delay, how it is that we're going to respond or live in light of that. The parable before this one was about being prepared for the parousia, the revelation of Jesus. The other one is about, the one that's going to follow right after this, is about the division that takes place at the appearance of God's kingdom, the division between those who are truly active part of that and those who aren't. So to think that Jesus took a break from this context that he's in just to weigh in on unfair economic systems in the world, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. It doesn't certainly flow contextually. And that's something that we still have to keep in mind when we're reading parables like this. When Jesus is telling these stories, we have to interpret these properly. These aren't stories told as commentaries about the subject of the story. You see what I'm saying? The stories are told to illustrate a different truth. So in other words, when he's telling a story here, he's not trying to weigh in on the elements of that story. He's trying to use them as props to describe something else, to describe a bigger truth. So when Jesus told the parable of the sower, you know, the guy going out planting seeds everywhere, he wasn't trying to explain proper farming techniques or soil evaluation or anything like that. That wasn't the subject matter. He was talking about spreading the good news of God's kingdom, and he was using those as props. So in this parable, Jesus is talking about the end of the age and the delay that's occurring. He's not trying to critique exploitive economic theories or practices. He's not even touching on the right or the wrong as it occurs with the landowner or any given economic system. They're just props. We get that, right? Do we understand what we're saying in that? So you know, we've got, there's where we've got to be careful with parables. We can get so wrought up in trying to, you know, make a connection between every single detail that's in there and get ourselves kind of tangled up in a mess in the whole thing. We want to look at the broader picture and understand the implication. Jesus, you know, he said this is like, it's like this kind of stuff. He's not saying it's exactly a mirror image of what's happening. Another potential problem with this parable or this story is it can be very easy to read this in a superficial way and use it to reinforce a works-based spirituality, you know, a works-based concept for how it is that we interact with God. You know, we can see it as, you know, either a works-based idea of gaining God's favor or a works-based in terms of a guilt motivator for people to give more in the offering or whatever. I mean, I've heard the parable taught both ways. People will assign, they'll look at this and they'll assign the meaning of the talents that are in this story to being our skills. You know, the word talent, the English word that we use for talent, actually comes from this parable, comes from the usage in this parable. So skills or talents that people have, when we say, oh, that person's very talented, we're referencing back to this actual parable. This is how the English language developed that concept. But I have trouble with just, you know, assigning it to skills, you know, use your skills. People will say, it's kind of like, you know, we need to get out there and put on the God's Kingdom's Got Talent show or something like that. It's kind of like the idea comes across, you know, if you're good at something, if you're a good baton twirler, twirl that baton for Jesus. And, you know, and that's fine, and you should, I guess. But the point is not necessarily what's being made in this parable. Or since in this story, a talent is a measure of currency in the Roman world, it was a sum of money worth about 15 years' wages. Think about what you've made over the last 15 years and realize this is the sum that he's talking about when he's describing this. So some people think this is Jesus telling everybody to start giving more in the offering on Sunday morning. And again, I would say, but he's using that as a metaphor. He's not going to be, you know, talking about the actual thing and using a metaphor that is talking about the actual thing. I don't even know if that makes sense, but you see, hopefully you're tracking with my discorded thoughts here. In my opinions, in my opinion, none, who else is in there, Rob? None of your business. Keep quiet. So in my singular opinion, none of these readings, when we look at this story, none of those really hold muster to what it is that he's trying to say or what he's trying to communicate. And I find them, honestly, to be very superficial readings of what it is that Jesus is communicating in here, at least as I'm seeing this, as I'm reading this. It's a story of a rich landowner who leaves his home country and he entrusts his goods, his vast sums of wealth, to his stewards, to three different stewards. And this isn't to say that God is exactly like a rich landowner or anything like this, but this story is using these images to show similarities. The amounts of money that he entrusts to his stewards is such an exaggerated amount. Most scholars actually look at it clearly as either hyperbole or even satire, and which gets me thinking about what it is that Jesus is intending this to be representative of. I believe, you know, when we talk about the vastness of these riches, we're singing songs about it this morning. We talk about the richness of the inheritance that we have in Christ. There's something, you know, Jesus, in talking with his disciples, has used this kind of terminology all along in terms of inheritance, in terms of what it is that his kingdom has provided to his disciples. I believe this is nothing less than the message of the gospel. This is nothing less than the advance of God's kingdom in this world. This is what he's left to his stewards to manage while he's gone. You know, the parable that Jesus told before this one encouraged us to be watchful during the long delay while we were waiting for the king to be revealed, to be watchful, to be prepared for the revelation of Jesus. I believe this is a story telling us what we should be doing while we wait, that we're to be occupied with something while we're waiting, and that is that God has entrusted us with advancing the good news of his kingdom, the good news of reconciliation with God, the good news of God's healing reign and rule coming to this earth. Now, This is where I got to tread carefully, because again, this story can so easily read as a works for reward kind of system. Because we got one guy who doubles 5 talents, the other guy doubles 2, and they're rewarded by the landowner saying, give them more talents, give them more stuff. And so people will sometimes say, you know, you've got to get busy. You got to get out there, start doing kingdom work, start doing all these things, or you're going to miss out on your final rewards. You see, there's rewards at stake in this whole thing. And so then it becomes this sort of works-based concept where the more I do, the happier God is with me, and, you know, I can get along in heaven later on or whatever. But we have to note something here, that when it comes to the reward that's implicit in this, there's actually only one reward actually talked about or described, and that is sharing in the joy of the landowner. That's the only reward that these stewards actually are given. The landowner is shown as giving more talents to those who have doubled theirs, but that is still the landowner's goods. It was his goods when he left. They're his goods as they were watching him. When he comes back, it's still all his stuff that he's providing there. He's just giving them more responsibility. And that's a reward for you. Good job. Here's more work to do. Ever been in a job like that? Either way, it doesn't matter. It's still a prop. Okay. So he, you know, in verse 21, he says, I'll set you over much. And in the New Living Translation, it reads, you've been faithful in handling this small amount. So now I'll give you many more responsibilities. Begin the joyous tasks that have been assigned to you. The rewards in this parable, in this story, the rewards that these two stewards enter into is joy. They get to enter into the sense of wholeness and well-being that's associated with this interaction with the landowner, the master that they've been serving. And, you know, so it's not a, you know, we give this warning, it's not a works for reward, but that is not to say that there are no works associated with our walk in Christ. Matthew's gospel mentions good works more than any of the others, but he never mentions it as a means to salvation. The Bible as a whole in the New Testament will reference doing good works, but never as a means of being able to procure from God a salvation. It's never mentioned as something to try to get on God's good side. We aren't saved by doing good, but we do good because we're saved, because our hearts have been changed, because now we're entering into the joy of the landowner. And this becomes the makeup of who we are as whole and fulfilled human beings. And the good work we're set to is the advancing of this good news. And the image of doubling the money carries the implication of more people being reconciled to God. You know, advancing this, it moves into this world, and more come into this reconciled relationship with God. That's what we're supposed to be about. That's what we as the church, as his followers, are supposed to be doing while we wait for the parousia, while we wait for the revelation of Jesus as King. We're supposed to be spreading the good news that God loves people and he wants to be reconciled with them. And of course, you know, that's going to happen in all kinds of different ways. That's going to happen through our conversations with people as we speak directly about the hope that we have in Jesus and we share with people those things. That's going to be revealed in how it is that we treat the people around us, how it is that we interact with our fellow human beings through the kindness and the love that we show. That's something that will come up more next week. But it's going to happen. These things, the advance of God's kingdom is going to happen in a lot of these unique ways. Listen, I'm going to say that it happens as we gather as a church and demonstrate what it's like to have a community under God, to live our lives out together, but in submission to God's rule, so that we begin to develop this way of interconnectivity under God's rule. That's one of the ways in which we're demonstrating and advancing the reality of God's kingdom. I guess, you know, more than anything, this just becomes an important reminder for us as the church that we're not here just to bide time. And we're not here to you know, we're not existing. We don't exist just to fall in step with the world's pursuits of things. You know, get as much stuff and power and pleasure and all these things that we can during the time we're here. We're not here to try to establish our own kingdom or our own thing that's going on. We're not trying to pass the years even hiding or, you know, backing away, trying not to get infected by the world. You know, we're just going to, you know, we used to use that phrase, occupy till he comes, but I'm not sure that's a great way to word that, because it really kind of sounds like, okay, we'll dig a trench, we'll hide in there, and, you know, until Jesus finally gets back, and try not to get infected by the world. No, we got a mission to accomplish. He actually sent us out to do something. And the question then that we have to ask ourselves, each of us individually or even collectively as a church, is, are we doing it? You know, he tells this story. Who are we in this story? It's an important thing about these parables. We've got to try on the characters ourselves. We've got to step into the shoes of each one of them, contemplate and see the world from that perspective, and then see how that fits. You know, do the characters that we don't like, does this fit way too closely to me? This looks like it was tailor-made for me. I don't like this. Are the ones that we like, you know, the ones that we admire, we try to put those on, and it's just, you know, this is very uncomfortable. I don't know. That's what his stories are meant to do for us. And so we have to ask ourselves, are we doing this? Are we about the advance of God's kingdom in this world? Sharing his love, sharing the reality of his care for humanity. Jesus, you know, seems to expect that our lives' primary purpose is going to be this mission. That kind of is what is coming across in these stories, if we're reading them right. It's easier for us, especially as Western American Christians, it's a whole lot easier for us to just see church or even our Christianity as kind of a side thing, kind of an ancillary, you know, thing that we put on as a portion of our lives, something that, you know, kind of has a little bit of influence there, but isn't that main issue. It's kind of a, you know, kind of a hobby we pursue. I sort of like God stuff, so I'll kind of look into this and I'll do this. But there's something far more radical that Jesus is calling us as the church to step into. And it's this mission. This mission to demonstrate and express the reality of God's good rule that intends to make all things new. But, you know, God has called us all to a life of mission. And there's something else that this story seems to reveal as I read it. You know, we're on this mission, but there's something else on this in the description of it, and that is that advancing the good news of God's kingdom is actually something that requires risk-taking on our part. This analogy of doubling money through investing is, you know, it's curious because it's not necessarily something that the Old Testament appreciated, and especially if it comes with interest or things like that. That's in violation of the Old Testament law. So, I mean, it's a curious thing that he uses here, this imagery that Jesus uses. And again, we're not trying to make too much about all the details, but there is something about this that connotes the idea of taking risks. It communicates that, this investment kind of concept. You know, and it's a reminder to us, even if we were to read this story differently, we still know that there's nothing safe about following Jesus. I mean, nothing at all. We risk being mocked or abused or rejected for sharing our hope in Jesus. Nothing at all like the nations what we were praying for this morning, to remember people in other parts of the world who don't have the freedom to join up with the church. You know, that's not something you do just kind of like, yeah, I'll go check it out. I mean, that's something you do when you're taking your life in your hands when you do it. But even for us, in a very protected kind of Disneyland-esque world that we live in here in the West, we still are taking a risk. We risk being mocked. We risk rejection. We risk our time and our energy in showing kindness and expressing grace and love when we have no idea if it'll actually change things or change the people, if people will even respond well to it. We have to take the risk of doing that, of following suit with Jesus. Jesus calls us to go out into a hostile world and show his love, to love unlovely people, to love, he says, our enemies. That's the people putting bombs in the streets and stuff, to love our enemies. And that's risky. And when you think about it, there is no such thing as love without risk. There is no such thing as love without risk. We go back all the way to the story of creation. God puts a tree in the middle of the garden. And he says, oh yeah, that tree, don't eat that tree. Don't eat from that tree. He allowed humanity, the opportunity to hurt him by putting that tree there. He took the risk that his love would be betrayed by placing that opportunity there. That's the kind of risk that's inherent in love. That's what God's communicating to us as the human race. That's the risk associated with it. It's not real love unless the one who receives the love has the ability to hurt the one who gives it. Because otherwise, it's just some sort of mechanical response. Otherwise, even worse, it's just coercion. Unless there's the possibility that the one receiving the love can hurt the one who gives it, it's not even love. So this is just, you know, when we talk about it being risky to go out and advance the good news is all about love. The good news is God's grace and radical inclusion. And that is going to carry with it these implicit risks. It's just the nature of our mission. But God never told us to play it safe, you know, take it easy. No, he said take up a cross and follow him every day. Every day. Can we take one day off? Nope, every day. That's just the nature of it. Jesus never told us to build a bunker and hide from the world. He never told us to create some sort of Christian subculture that's going to keep us safely removed from anything that threatens our worldview or our convictions somehow. Nope, not at all. Jesus sent us, anybody know where Jesus sent us? To the world. That's a very timid response there. To the world? To heaven? Jesus sent us into the world. And to illustrate what that's going to be like, Jesus said, hey, you know how sheep and wolves interact? I got some news for you. You're the sheep in this story. This is risky. He says, now be alert, be aware, but be harmless in the process. Harmless as we follow him into this. But it means we're going to take risks. It means we're also going to take risks by going into unlikely places and engaging questionable people along the way. It means that we're going to be open to unconventional ways of sharing the good news of God's kingdom. We're not going to be motivated by phrases like, we've never done it this way before. We're going to avoid those kind of phrases. We're going to be open to that because it's risky. This is risk-taking stuff he's talking about. It means we're not just going to angrily critique our present culture. We're going to look for positive ways to engage our culture. And, you know, we always recoil with, yeah, but people are going to think we approve of this or that. Yes. Yes, they are. It's the exact same problem Jesus faced when he was walking around embracing tax collectors and prostitutes and all of the people that were abhorred within that culture. Yes, we run the risk of looking as though we're approving of something that God may not approve of. Doesn't matter. That's not our job description. Calm down, Rob. Oh, I will. I will. It's not that big of a deal. Just talk. Just talk normally. Okay, I will. It's just, you know, a love for safety is not what defined Jesus' ministry. It's not what defined the work of the early church. It's not what defined that of radicals like Francis of Assisi or the reformers or any significant move in the church. A love for safety is not what defined it. A willingness to risk it all, a pledging of the head to heaven is what defined it. In fact, just the opposite of that. A desire for increased safety, a failure to take a risk, is exactly what earned the rebuke of the landowner in this story. And why didn't this guy take any risks? Why did he want to do this? And okay, so that's the question we have to ask. Why did this guy not want to take any risks? And the answer to that is intriguing to me. I mean, extremely thought-provoking. Some have complained as they've read this story. You go over the various commentators that are out there, and some have complained that the landowner is harsh and he's unloving in this story. The story, therefore, he can't be representative of God. But I would like to suggest that the story really isn't representing the landowner that way. Only the third steward is. He's the only one who says this. When the landowner asks for an accounting, the third steward complains, saying, "I knew you were a strict man. I was afraid." It's in total contrast to the way the first two stewards interacted with the landowner. And, you know, they were familiar, they were friendly, and that whole interaction was characterized by joy. That's even what he says, enter into this joy. So entering into the joy means that there was joy present in that whole interaction. There was something favorable and pleasant and friendly going on there. And, you know, the landowner doesn't really correct the steward when he describes him as being a hard man who does, you know. But he says, in essence, it comes off as a question. And so it could easily be read like, so if this was your perception of me, you know, if you knew that I was like this, if this is what you believed you knew, if this was your view, why didn't it affect your strategy? Why didn't it have an impact on your life if this was really what you believe about me? And I want to suggest something here, and I got to be, you know, I want to suggest a thought, okay? I had to do this last week too, because, you know, this is Rob, the guy with the voices or whatever, but it's a thought. So it's not a for sure doctrinal statement or anything like that, but it's something to consider, to mull over, to argue with, or whatever. But, and again, I want to be careful about this, but could God become for us what we believe God to be? That is, for those who believe that God is gracious and loving and forgiving to them, God is that. But for those who believe God to be hard and demanding and judgmental to them, God is that. And I certainly don't believe that God is somehow created by our images of him, or that our perception of God has any impact on the reality of who God is. I'm not saying that. God is the same yesterday, forever. It doesn't matter what we think about him, he is still the same. But I'm saying that it's possible that our inadequate beliefs about God, if we're persistent and stubborn in those beliefs, maybe they create perception blinders so that we're unable to see the whole picture of God that Jesus reveals him to be for us. That we refuse to see him any other way or conceive of him any other way. So that's then how our interactions with him go, because that's the perception blinders that we wear. In fact, I think that this terrible perception of the landowner held by the third steward is the key to understanding the whole ending of this story, because to me, the entire story pivots on that one point. So I think what this could be telling us is that failure to really know God's goodness circumvents the work of God's kingdom, to really know and believe in his goodness. It's a hard ending to this story. It really is. What happens with this guy? But I believe it's a hard ending, but not necessarily the way many people believe. I think this story is warning us about how we view God, how we understand him. I believe that how we think about God is critical to how the kingdom manifests in our world, in the world around us. It's very possible that this story is telling us that our image of God has consequences to it. And God is deeply concerned that we get it right, that we see him as Jesus has revealed him to us. That if we reject the image of God as good and just and generous, we end up rejecting the kingdom. And so we have chosen to live our lives in outer darkness. It's so we choose death over life. And that's exactly the failure of the Pharisees, as we see it evolve through the Gospels. They saw God as this harsh, demanding God of the law, and they treated others accordingly. They buried the idea of God's kingdom and his rule in Israel, not letting it go anywhere else when they were called. Israel was called to be a light to the world. They rejected Jesus and his presentation of a loving, forgiving, and gracious God. They wanted none of the risk-taking inclusiveness that Jesus represented. They, even though they considered themselves the representatives of God's kingdom, missed out on it entirely, stayed in the outer darkness, got swept away in the events of 70 AD. I think he's trying to communicate something about the folly of that third steward. basing his actions on a misconceived concept, on a self-revelation, a self-imposed revelation of who God is. So this is, I mean, you know, we see that this played out that way for the Pharisees, but this becomes a challenge for us as well in the church. We've got to get a clear view of who God is and what his rule is like if we're going to be effectively advancing his rule in this world. If we're going to enter into the joy that the first two stewards know, we need to believe that joy is representative of what it is that God's doing. So much of the evangelical church, in so many ways, seems like it's afraid of losing or somehow endangering God. You know, so much of what we do is driven by this fear that, you know, well, you know, heck, like, you know, we're supposed to be protecting God from any adventures. Better be careful, God. It's going to get exciting here. You don't want any part of this. We can't risk this radical inclusion of people who seem a little suspicious. You know, that could ruin God's reputation. It could compromise God's character when we think like that. And I'm telling you, I interact with people, with leadership, who thinks like that. Honestly, trying to protect God is just, to me, a variant of not trusting God. Can't we believe he's big enough and good enough and capable enough to steer us through this so that we can just love indiscriminately like he told us to? Trusting that he's going to work these things out. We've got to stop trying to bury the gospel to keep it safe. We've got to stop trying to hide God under a mattress somewhere. As we begin to trust, allowing God to move through us, putting our hope in Christ, not in our industry of religion, our lives will begin to change. As our trust is placed on the bigness and the goodness of God, our lives begin to change. As we see ourselves as people who are not only the products of his love, but also the recipients of his loving care and molding. Man, our worldviews change, our actions change, the way we live and our priorities change, and suddenly we see our families begin to change. And to me, I mean, that's where our neighborhoods stand the better chance of changing. It's not going to be through all of our different machinations of political maneuvers or anything like that. It's through accepting the reality of God's goodness, embracing his loving rule over our lives, and seeing how that moves out from us like concentric circles from a pebble being dropped in a pond. The never-ending riches of the gospel have been entrusted to us as the church. Riches that change hearts and minds. Riches that reconcile humanity to God. That carry with it the potential of righting the wrongs, and certainly carry with it the promise that one day all things get made new. All of this stuff that's so horrible in this world, that's so painful, gets changed. And one day he'll make it all new. That's the never-ending riches of the hope and the promise and the gospel that God's given to us to share in this world. So let's determine, as individual followers of Jesus, as the individuals who make up the church, let's put our faith in the goodness of God, in his love for humanity, so that we can be effective in participating in God's kingdom as it's revealed in this world, and be a part of that new world when it arrives in the parousia. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, please? Well, let's speak this blessing on each other before we bail out. If you need prayer for anything, Shirley's here. I'll be here. Be glad to pray with you. Let's say this together. May the peace of the Lord Christ be with you wherever he may send you. May he guide you through the wilderness, protect you through the storm. May he bring you home rejoicing at the wonders he has shown you. May he bring you home rejoicing once again into these doors. Go in peace, you children of God.